VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, this is the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer and he's Gregor Robertson. Today we're joined in the studio by Alison Rudd. Hello everyone, how are you all doing?
Hello, Natalie.
Hello.
Hello, hello. Doing well?
Very well. You?
I'm fine. Alison, I imagine you're a little unhappy after last night's events, which we will get on to, but are you okay?
I took it out on tennis. I tend to do that a lot, don't I?
Yes, poor tennis balls. That's all we can say. Now, coming up, we're talking about the impact that the coronavirus is having on football and the problems with playing behind closed doors. Plus, we're going to be joined by Rebecca Myers as England's She Believes Cup campaign draws to a dismal close. First, though, we're looking back on this week's Champions League action. And Liverpool crashed out of the Champions League this week. Jurgen Klopp's side failed to reach the final for the first time in 3 years after Atletico Madrid beat them in extra time in their last 16 tie. Klopp wasn't exactly very happy about it. Once again, he questioned the Atletico boss Diego Simeone's style of football. This is what he had to say. I'm completely happy with the Liverpool performance. It's so difficult to play a side like this, Klopp told BT Sport, adding he was searching for the right words. He went on to say, I don't understand with the quality they have, the football they play. They could play proper football, but they stand deep and have counter-attacks. We accept it, of course, but it doesn't feel right tonight. I realise I'm a really bad loser, especially when the boys put such an effort in against world-class players on the other side who defend with two rows of four. Alison, is Klopp right to be so frustrated?
Of course he's right to be frustrated. Liverpool played so well compared to the first leg where they just couldn't summon anything on target. They had a lot of possession but weren't imaginative with it. And they succumbed to the discipline of Atletico and a particularly amazing home support. I was almost shocked with just how much they progressed from that to Anfield, because Atletico were exactly the same. They play so deep you don't need a flag for offside anymore. You can never be offside when you're playing against Atletico. Often, you know, there were eight bodies in the area. I mean, and yet regularly throughout the game, Liverpool were using the flanks. They were using every inch of the pitch to try and thwart that. So if I was in charge of that team, I'd be so proud that they'd worked on it. They'd analyse what Atletico do, how we can get through it. It's that then it becomes wrong, if you like, to have a go, because it was the best of football that stopped Liverpool winning, because their keeper was in amazing form. There were lots and lots of intelligent, solid tackling and marking, lots of anticipation of where the deadly ball was going to come from. And that isn't anti-football, that's real football. I mean, I was really impressed with Atletico in the first leg, because I was there for that one, with their concentration levels. That is part of football, and they did it as a masterclass in that. And their breakaways, if you have so few breakaways and you make them all count, amazing. And if your sub keeper, if your Liverpool, isn't up to the job, well, that's Klopp's fault as well. I mean, he's picked the wrong sub. So I understand completely why he's angry, and he probably said things that don't sound polite, and everyone should be more gracious in defeat. I understand completely why he's frustrated, because Liverpool played beautifully. I tweeted, this is achingly, frustratingly beautiful, because it was beautiful, but it wasn't getting them anywhere. I have sympathy with Klopp, but it's don't start calling Atletico a team that play football the wrong way. Yes, they've got great players, but you need great players to do it that way, because those tackles and those passes out of defence when they could were superb.
It's even more than that. It's persuading great players to play like that. I think that's increasingly hard in modern football. The use of the word proper, you know, as if this is an improper football.
Yes.
It was a little, you know, he was in the heat of the moment. It's a press conference after the game. I'm sure he doesn't really mean that. There's plenty of ways to play football. And I completely agree. I don't think people really understand quite what a feat it is to concentrate and defend like that for 120 minutes. Mm. And then you add the 90 minutes from the first leg as well. It's astonishing, really. Mm.
But it is because we are so used to now the expansive style of football,
yeah.
the beautiful game that we're now witnessing, that people forget there are other ways of playing.
Absolutely.
And just as effective, as it proved last night.
Yeah, I mean, although that is a dying art, there's no two ways about that.
Yeah.
What Simeone gets his team to do is a dying art, but that doesn't make it any less football. And it's actually, for a neutral, it's quite kind of refreshing to see that players are still so committed and so organised and disciplined and all these things, and willing to do it and willing to play like that. And also, I mean, I think it's also given a bit of a lack of credit. There were spells in the game, I think kind of midway to the sort of end of the first half, where Atletico started to knock it about and keep the ball a bit as well. And also, their set pieces were incredible. And the time to try to kind of break, obviously Liverpool had a high line, they almost got in the first minute as well. And from some of the set plays, they created chances. You know, but I've seen people saying that Atletico didn't really defend that well because Liverpool had chances. They're playing against one of the best teams, probably still the best attacking unit in Europe, even when they've gone out. And they withheld them. So, I mean, absolutely kudos to them.
And also, if you were an Atletico fan, I think you would have enjoyed it. I don't think the people supporting that club would have been thinking, oh, I'm really annoyed now. This is just getting tiresome. I think watching that unfold and knowing there were going to be spasms of attack and seeing how lethal they were would have been quite thrilling.
Hmm. I mean, it certainly was, as you pointed out, Gregor, for the neutral. It was really thrilling to watch, see who would come out of that battle with the winner. But, Alison, in the space of 12 days... Liverpool have missed out on the chance of becoming a Premier League invincible. They've been dumped out of the FA Cup, subsequently ending their hopes of the treble. And now they've missed out on the chance to retain their world championship status for next season. Where's it all gone wrong?
Well, I think it's gone right again.
What?
No, I'm intrigued. I'm paused. I'm waiting to hear.
Me too.
I think the gap, the 3-week gap between the first leg of the Champions League tie in Madrid and Wednesday night's game, so having seen what unfolded on Wednesday night, I got the impression that Liverpool were in some sort of stasis, sort of just getting through until they could meet Atletico again. And having seen how well they'd thought through the best way to combat, or what they thought would allow them to combat Simeone's side, showed to me that maybe they've been spending an awful lot of time on computer models and training about that game. It felt like everything had been almost on hold until they could be at Anfield for what was going to be a rocking atmosphere, and there might have been a subconscious belief at the club that it would kickstart them again, having gone into a lull that I don't think is a ridiculous thing to happen when a team's performing so well. You will get lulls. And I think there was a feeling that once they showed their true credentials in the Champions League, everything would rev back up again. The only thing that went wrong was the result, because I do think Liverpool, I think individually, apart from the goalkeeper, everyone did something really good that was an improvement on what we've seen in recent weeks. I think as a unit, they just looked that wonderful unit that we've been purring about most of the season and our rightful title elect. Although the result was appalling and kind of weird and upsetting, what they now have to do is take from that they You know, the fact that Gregor says, you know, they're still the best team in the world. They have the best, when they look like that again. So they have to be able to take that and know that they're not going to meet another team from now till the end of the season. They're not going to meet a team that can do that to them, probably. They've got that is their rough patch gone. And yes, they were capable of doing both, because they got such a big lead in the Premier League. They were capable of winning the title and winning the Champions League. So that's why it's really disappointing, because they had it, and they just came up against a team that was just incredibly well disciplined.
I kind of have to agree. I think that such fine margins we're talking about, and it was a pretty glaring error from the goalkeeper. Otherwise, it might have been very different. And I think I agree, there was a lot of thought put into the game. There was things you noticed right at the start, like Trent Alexander-Arnold almost playing like an inside right midfielder, Oxlade-Chamberlain going wide, just to manoeuvre, to find spaces to get crosses into the box from the right sort of angle that would hurt the defenders. Oxlade-Chamberlain was superb as well, like kind of some of his surging runs down the right. Salah, another day, when he cuts inside, he finds a corner. It was very fine margins, and that's knockout football at the very elite level, so I don't think Liverpool... Look, it is going to be, whatever way you look at it, it's not the season that we thought it was going to be. I think we all thought they were going to go through the league invincible. You know, the FA Cup was a bit of an afterthought for them, let's be honest. But the Champions League as well. If they, you know, we thought there was a real chance of a double. And, you know, the league still, after 30 years, is a good thing to fall back on. But it's a bit of a whimper, I think, still.
Well, this is what I was going to say,
It feels like a whimper now in the aftermath of a very strange knockout game. But when the moment comes, winning the Premier League title won't feel like a whimper at all.
Yeah, we're going to come on to talk about that. Let's hope it does come.
Yes, we'll talk about that in a little while, Gregor. But continuing on the Champions League theme, Tottenham's campaign came to an end on Tuesday night. The task was tough enough, heading to Germany a goal behind, not to mention doing it with the length of the injury list that Jose Mourinho had. But Spurs ended up being hammered, in truth, by RB Leipzig. The tie finished 4-0. Alison, you covered this game as well, and afterwards you wrote, Tottenham were outclassed by a team with a strong identity, brimming with confidence, while Jose Mourinho's side is a patchwork effort these days as he copes with injuries and bad luck. So, was the defeat simply down to bad luck and injuries? Or is there more to it?
There is more to it, but yeah, I think any criticism of Mourinho, you have to accept that's a lot on your plate. And it's been bad news after bad news for him. But it's the mark of a great manager, how they handle it. I don't know what they're doing on the training ground at the moment, but when Spurs come out to play, they look tired. And so I think it's going wrong. They look overworked. I use the phrase, they shoot horses, don't they? Because it was almost painful to watch, because I think Spurs tried. They were trying, but it was sometimes it was like watching people running in sand. There was effort, but it took them so much effort just to keep going and to try and concentrate, because Leipzig were, you know, they came out having fun. They were great. You know, I think you could see that they thought, oh, this is going to be awful. But they kept trying, but too much mental and physical effort was going into can we cope over 90 minutes and not get too embarrassed, as opposed to, and you've got a big injury list, where's our imagination? What can we do to thwart Leipzig? How can we surprise them? How can we adapt to their system? It was plodding. But it felt inevitably plodding, because he had nobody on the bench to make any statement at all. There was no one to fear on the bench. And I mentioned Leipzig's identity high up in my report, because one way you can counter bad luck and injuries is if you've got a system and a strong identity, you can slot people into that if they're all schooled into it. Mm. So in theory, say, a youngster like Troy Parrott instead of treating him the way Mourinho has treated him, you've just used him as, this is somebody who's going to help us. Let's make sure he understands this is the Spurs way under Mourinho. This is our identity. And if I put you on the pitch, you know exactly what we're going to do. There's absolutely no point putting someone young like that on the pitch because he won't know what Spurs are going to do because they do not have an identity. Before kickoff, it was 50-50 in the press box how they were going to line up. Would it be four at the back, three at the back, five at the back? How are they going to line up? Because we don't know what Spurs are anymore. And even when we saw the team sheet, we weren't entirely sure, is Eric Dier going to play in midfield or not? It was very, as I said, patchwork. And one of the criticisms of Mourinho is that he's just very good at making sure that excellent players are well drilled and don't get overexcited and the outcome is correct. When he needs to be a bit more flexible and tweak things, I just don't get the impression he has much of a big imagination.
Well, obviously, we've always spoken, Gregor, about how Jose Mourinho behaves and the way he speaks of his players, let's say. And he came into this tie bemoaning his injuries, and we'll give him that because they have had a lot of injuries. But after the game, he reflected as well on the fact that the RB Leipzig bench could walk into the Tottenham starting 11. Why is he not getting it? That some of the things he's saying is just not helpful.
Well, I think the first thing he says is that he must not be like that in the changing room. He can't be. There are kind of noises that even at Manchester United when he was throwing Luke Shaw under the bus or Chris Smalling, that it was almost a persona for the press, and then he's someone very different behind the scenes. And I think that's probably true again, but it all feeds into the narrative about Jose Mourinho now. It reminds me of a playing for a manager once who constantly was saying that he was going to sign a whole new team. He was, after every game we lost, we're on a bad run, we're going to go, none of you are good enough, he was saying it to our faces and stuff. And one day, a player who was quite a big character in the dressing room just sort of stood up and said, well, go and effing do it then. And he said, I can't, my hands are tied, I haven't got any money. Right. And it's like, what's the point then? You've got, it's the same sort of thing, because nowadays players will listen to what Jose Mourinho is saying. They've got Twitter and all these things, and they'll see what he's saying publicly. So, it's different when it comes to Ndombele. That was a message to Daniel Levy saying, this guy is not good enough. He's not worth the money you paid for him. He's not going to play for me, basically. But when he's saying that about their entire bench can get in, could play in my team now, then, I mean, sorry, that's demoralising for what any player you're talking about. I'm conflicted about Mourinho. Part of me thinks he's a busted flush. I think he's, as I said, the way that Simeone and Atletico Madrid play, that is a dying, dying art. And Mourinho is still at heart a pragmatist who, first and foremost, he wants his team not to concede goals, and then he wants to have sterling players where he gets them in the final third and says, go and do what you can and get us a goal. On one hand, Spurs aren't good enough at the moment to play like that because they've got Son and Harry Kane out injured. But on the other hand, I don't think it's ever going to work. I don't think that kind of football is ever going to win the Premier League. Or it might get Tottenham in the top four. It might win them the League Cup or even the FA Cup. But as Alison's saying, that's not a plan. That's not an identity for Tottenham in the long term. And I think fundamentally his presence is at odds with what Tottenham has been for so many years. And Daniel Levy must be looking. I think he got rid of a guy who kind of told his players to dream and to create a team that was greater than the sum of its parts, They did some, he was emotional and Mourinho is a guy who sucks the life force out of you. And it was all really just so with a hope that he would get into the Champions League and get another year of Champions League money because they need it.
Is there still room in the game then for Jose Mourinho, Alison?
Well, I think that's the pity of it in a way because this is such a big test for him, with the injuries. You know, Tottenham Hotspur without Son, without Kane, is, we know it's depleted and requires a little touch of genius. And I just don't get the impression Mourinho's thinking, I've got that genius. I can.
You think he's
I
lost can. His kind of self belief, his mojo?
Well, it was. He was. So I was with him for 2 days. I mean, I had two press conferences with him, and it. He was smiling a lot, but his words were negative. So somebody said, "You know, miracles are possible. Look at what happened to Spurs when they overcame Ajax against the odds." And the first thing he said was, "I don't have the options off the bench that Pochettino had."
Yeah.
Well, that's in what way is that giving anybody the sense that they could do it? Mm. He's basically telling his team, as well as us, telling his team,
just came over.
I can't do a miracle because I really your only miracle relies on having Llorente on the bench. I mean, why say it? Why concentrate on what you don't have instead of winking and saying it's okay? I know what a miracle is.
Mm. Yeah.
And then you get under the skin of Leipzig, don't you? What's he on about? And then they're thinking, well, it is Mourinho.
Yeah.
You know, Mourinho always wins trophies.
What special tricks does he have?
Yeah, you've got to make people think you've got a plan. And he was basically saying, my injury list is a joke, and I don't even have people on the bench that Pochettino had.
But that's also the problem, the way he moans about things, you lose sympathy for him because of the way he handles the situation, Gregor.
Yeah, he's not. I mean, Spurs were likeable, and they're no longer a likeable team. They're no longer a team that the neutral kind of enjoys watching. And it's happened in such a short space of time as well. Everything he's saying is, to an extent, that's the way the counterbalance to this is. It's true. He's the chronic underinvestment by Levy and the squad. Yes, they've got a gleaming new stadium, but at what cost now? They've discarded a manager who is now probably the most coveted unemployed manager in Europe, and they've replaced him with a guy who really increasingly looks like yesterday's man. So, if I was a Tottenham fan, I would be sort of pretty worried about the future. Not only that, because even if he does get money now, would you want Jose Mourinho to be the guy who's constructing a new squad? He wants to go out and sign the guys who are 28 and 29 who are ready to do the job now. That's what he always says. No, I think, look, he's going to be around for a while yet, but I don't see it being a good marriage in the future.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no,
I don't know,
yes.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
England manager Phil Neville said it was totally acceptable for people to question his position after defeat to Spain in their final She Believes Cup match, which turns out to be a seventh loss in 11 games. The defeat comes after a victory over Japan and also a loss to the USA earlier in the tournament. Rebecca Myers has been covering it for The Times, and I'm pleased to say she joins us now here on The Game. Hello, Rebecca.
Hi guys, how are you?
Very, very well. But all very disappointing for the Lionesses once again.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, no sort of positive headlines this morning, really. I mean, he hung in there with that. You know, no one necessarily expects him to beat the US. So I think while that match was extremely disappointing at the beginning, it comes with that sort of caveat. Second match against Japan, Ellen White saved the day. We got through that 1-0 win through the skin of our teeth. And then this match, I think, was really kind of the epitome of everything that's going wrong at the moment. as you just said, that seven losses in 11, it's not good enough. And what I'm kind of struggling with this morning, and what I think a lot of people are struggling with from kind of the fan base and maybe other reporters, is that, you know, we have heard this before. There doesn't seem to be any question from within that, you know, his position is at risk. I'm not personally advocating for that, but it seems like quite a unique conversation to women's football, maybe. I can't think of any situation in men's football where a manager would lose 7 in 11 games of a very highly ranked side and still, you know, pretty much be assumed to be staying in the job. I mean, Phil kind of alluded to that himself. He talked about being under David Moyes and him having a worse streak than Phil's had now, and you know, his job being called into question. So he's obviously aware of it, but you know, I think there's a sort of a bit of a strange situation where, you know, what isn't changing, what isn't happening. You know, we keep saying we need to change. We've been saying that now since, well, you know, if you take aside the World Cup, at least since November. So yeah, I think it is quite a strange situation.
Do you feel, though, with regards to discussions, which I'm not privy to, I'm not sure if the FA are even discussing whether or not Phil Neville should be in charge of England anymore, but do you think a lot of the reasons, or one of the reasons as to why they may not be making a decision, is because of the upcoming Olympics?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, and again, I'm not sitting at those tables within the FA either, but certainly the understanding was that, you know, you can't get a new manager in now and expect to do well at the Olympics in the summer. Obviously, with everything that's going on, there's a chance the Olympics won't go ahead anyway. And the kind of key project and the key focus has been, and they have stated, it's the home Euros next year. So I suppose you're now looking at, well, and obviously we can't make any decisions on the basis the Olympics aren't going ahead, but if for whatever, you know, if for coronavirus reasons, for example, they don't, still unlikely, but if they don't, then you're looking at kind of, well, we have got time, you know, there is a year and a bit to go to the home Euros. And I mean, that also factors into stuff like he's using very young players, which is great, really exciting to see. That was the kind of purpose of this tournament, giving them that game time. But I think that, you know, the sort of telling point is that the problems we're seeing are the same problems. And certainly, you know, no shots on target last night at all in the game against Spain. And that's playing with an extremely experienced, very good set of forwards who, you know, that's not using sort of random players who have zero caps. These are the Ellen Whites and Nikita Parises. So something is clearly going wrong there.
Rebecca, it's Alison. Are you actually saying that Phil has lost the dressing room?
Well, that's even more interesting, because I sort of think he hasn't lost the dressing room, and that's kind of quite surprising. Like, the players seem to be very behind him, or certainly outwardly and in their, you know, their press conferences and all of that, they seem to be really quite united. I mean, I saw another reporter suggesting that the blow of the World Cup and having lost that has basically gone to their heads completely, and maybe we shouldn't have demanded so much of them from the World Cup, which is a sort of interesting way to look at it. But I think you kind of almost can't play that game of looking backwards and going, or with hindsight, blah, blah, blah. But they have always been really behind Phil, even through bad results. They've almost treated criticism of Phil as criticism of them, which is quite interesting. So, you know, maybe he does still have the dressing room, and maybe he can turn this round.
Why would he? I don't understand why he would have the dressing room. If he's bringing through young players, that implies that some players are being dumped or rested. And if they're not showing signs of something, I mean, it'd be all right if he had this terrible record, but you could see that there was a new pattern of play and they were more expansive and more entertaining and they were developing a style that looked like, you know, in 6 months' time they might be able to beat the US. But if these tinkerings aren't leading to any plaudits in terms of, you can see what the future might hold, but some players are being overlooked, maybe some players are coming in when they're not ready, I don't see why anyone would be happy.
Yeah, exactly. And I wonder whether this introduction of new players and different faces might then also change that. I mean, we've seen quite a lot of conversation that during the She Believes around Ellen White and Beth England. Obviously, Beth England didn't go to the World Cup. She's an incredible player. And people wanted to see a lot more of her than we did. And Ellen, Phil was sort of saying, well, there was disrespect shown to Ellen for people saying that, you know, she shouldn't necessarily start and give Beth a chance. And that was the first sign of some sort of, you know, for me, maybe a little bit of disquiet or unhappiness there.
Well, it is interesting because Nikita Paris has certainly come out to defend Phil Neville. I mean, she was saying, I don't believe Phil as the manager should get absolutely hammered by the media. I think we should, she says. You have to be hard on us because ultimately we are the ones stepping out into that arena. He is putting in the work and we are not delivering for him. When you go back to last year and the last She Believes Cup, obviously England won that and optimism was so high heading into the World Cup. So can you actually put any kind of reasoning as to where it has all gone wrong?
Yeah, I don't, and maybe that is that point again about is it just this World Cup? But it's too long now to call it a hangover. We can't keep saying this is a World Cup hangover. It's, what was it now, like 8 months ago? It's too long ago. I think that's quite interesting that she's coming out and saying, you know, we should take some of the fact too. I think there is still a slightly uneasy relationship with criticism within the women's game. The players have spoken quite a lot about this since the World Cup. They weren't really prepared for the criticism that they got, both from the media and fans. Now, you know, as the media, we aren't doing our job if we're saying 1-0 defeat against Spain. Well, it was still a great match. That's patronising. Players don't want that. But I think also they weren't necessarily ready for the scrutiny that they came under. And part of me thinks that might also be why there isn't necessarily, you know, mutiny against Phil, because they take criticism quite prickly. It's quite a difficult issue, and I think there's solidarity there with saying, well, we're not used to this and we don't want it all the time. I think that is a still really difficult relationship.
Just lastly, Rebecca, got to get your thoughts on what else Phil Neville has had to say and how he's not happy with the FA in the way that the England team have travelled to and from the US. And what's the latest you have on that?
Yeah, so this is a brilliant report by Molly this morning, and Molly's been out in the US for us and her coverage has been phenomenal. She is reporting, as a lot of other papers are this morning, that the England women are going to fly back in business class, which is, I'm sorry to say, an improvement on the way they got there, but in a commercial flight. And, you know, we're in the middle of a coronavirus pandemic. I cannot fathom a world in which male players, international male players for a team like England, would not get a chartered flight during a pandemic and would go through a busy airport like anybody else. I just think it's disgraceful. To his credit, Phil has come out and been very critical of that. He said, I'm quite angry about that. We have to start protecting them a goddamn lot better, was his phrase. But part of me thinks, well, if he really feels like that, I'm not sure why it's happened. I'm not, you know, party to quite how much influence he has, but they flew out there in premium economy. That we were told that was because there wasn't enough seats for all the players to be in business. But to me, that suggests that there was a booking, you know, an organisational error that should have been dealt with earlier. And part of me thinks, well, you know, if you set those standards at the beginning, why are we surprised that they're flying back in, alongside other passengers who could have come from anywhere in the world? I think it's really disappointing. You know, it's one thing when female athletes get treated differently to male athletes, but it's another when it actually puts their health and their safety at risk.
Rebecca, brilliant. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Rebecca. So that was Rebecca Myers speaking to us, and she's been across the She Believes Cup, as has Molly Hudson, who's been out in America for The Times. Now, as mentioned by Rebecca Myers there, Phil Neville was unhappy that the Lionesses will be travelling back from America on a commercial plane when you consider the coronavirus that is affecting the world. It has been declared a pandemic by the World Health Organization. And at the time of recording, we are awaiting more news around sport in Britain and the next course of action to be taken. We know, of course, many games across Europe have been affected by coronavirus, with either games being played behind closed doors or even entire postponements of leagues, as we're seeing more regularly. More recently in the Premier League, we had our first postponement during the week as Arsenal's tie with Manchester City was hit following the North London side's contact with the Olympiacos owner Evangelos Marinakis. And the discussion we're going to have now, I guess, Alison and Gregor, centres on comments that Pep Guardiola made when he was asked about the situation with regards to coronavirus and whether or not he would want games to be played behind closed doors. His response was, well, does football work without spectators? And is he right, Alison? Would that be the right thing to do?
No, I mean, philosophers will say, if a tree falls in the forest and no one's there to see it, has it actually fallen in the forest? I think football has the crowd it deserves. So when I played in Regent's Park on a Thursday night, nobody watched me. And that was quite right. And then you go, do you have your school games? And they're like 50 parents on the touchline. Absolutely. That's what that game deserves. And you go up through the levels and you get to clubs that have players on $120,000 a week and are finely tuned and honed and the best managers for that team, and everything is elite, elite, elite. For what? There is only one reason for that, because of the passion behind those clubs, the emotional investment. If you watch any top level match, whether you're there or you're watching it on TV, as much as you might think you're there watching 90 minutes of football, you're not. You're listening to the crowd, you're watching the crowd. The person in charge of the camera shots would have a horrible, horrible time if he couldn't pan to the child crying, the fat bloke screaming, the old man falling asleep because it was so boring. And when you're reporting on a match, because you're typing so much, I mean, sometimes you have 1,100 words to type before the final whistle. You've got to look down at your keyboard or you look at your screen, and you find what you're doing is you're watching a game via the crowd. Mm. You know what's coming and what's gone and what might be about to happen, because the crowd are very informed and they are part of the entertainment. So for me, taking away football, elite football, behind closed doors is like saying, I'm going to go to the Royal Opera House, but there will be no tenors. And that, there'll be no violinists. Mm. It's just ridiculous. You either do it or you don't do it. I wish I was medically informed enough, because I think what would be the best thing would be to just say all public events, no public events at all, whether it's the theatre or football, for 2 weeks, shut down the tubes and just say stop. And then football, I think, would like that, and then they could come back and they'd be actually happy for the first time ever to have an overcrowded schedule where they're playing once every 3 days to catch up. That would be the answer. An elongated period of football behind closed doors is too abysmal to contemplate.
I agree. I mean, when I flicked over from Liverpool the other night to the Dortmund PSG game, and they were just, the final whistle was just about to be blown, and it was blown and they were all celebrating on the pitch. Thomas Tuchel, the PSG manager, ran on and he was kind of embracing the players, and there was no one to do it with. It felt completely wrong. It was kind of, the stadium was empty. I mean, that's before we talk about how there was thousands of people congregated outside, which is another reason why this does seem fairly pointless. It also, I've played in games, kind of reserve games when I was younger, in big stadiums or early rounds of cup games that like nobody cared about, and there's maybe 100 people there.
But that's what that deserved, presumably.
Yeah, I know.
They weren't staying away because they knew Gregor was playing and he was going to be awful.
I hope not. No, I know. But the point is, when you're on the pitch, it's rubbish as well. So it's not. There's no one who wins except probably the competition organisers, possibly broadcasters. For the players, it's rubbish as well. Fans can't get in to see it. Really, there's no winner. And I agree. I think I'm just amazed that it's. I mean, it should be called off. We've been last. It might be by the time the listeners are listening to this. But it seems astonishing that the Premier League's been the last to do it.
Just on that then, is it actually even for the good of the game that you postpone matches? Because, I mean, how important is a crowd for a game when it's something like a league match?
Just exactly what Alison's saying. I think that the football without fans to sort of commune with, yeah. Feels very hollow for the players on the pitch as well. It's not, it doesn't feel like the same occasion, it doesn't feel like it has the same weight of importance.
Like making love to a robot, that's what it is.
No, but think about it.
No,
think
I
about
know
it.
You're right, no. Absolutely.
I mean, I think football in an empty stadium is really almost pointless.
Okay, that is it for now. Many thanks to our guests today, Alison Rudd and Rebecca Myers.
Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet.
It's just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information, and we'll be back on Monday.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code Program.